Testing, 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 1, 2, hello, welcome to the program. This is PlainsTribune.com's broadcast, special broadcast. So let me just give a quick overview of what you can expect. So we're doing a live format show now. We're actually going to run this whole hour live, and we're here in the studio. We've got our production crew handy. We're going to be running our ads and everything else just as though we're doing a live hour of radio, to get in the habit of doing that. Because that's eventually what we'd like to do. We'd like to do a live broadcast right out of our studio here in Spearfish, South Dakota, broadcasting from the corner of Canyon and Jackson. This is the Plains Tribune, I guess, Friday mashup, which we're going to have every Friday. It should be available every Friday, come hell or high water, Lord willing, and the creek don't rise. At 4 o'clock is when we would like to have this available. So we're going to shoot for that, and we're training. Thank you for tuning into this. We're taking it seriously, and we appreciate you being here with this broadcast. Now, my name is John Dale. I'm the host. On this broadcast, on this hour, we're gonna get into some technology. We're going to talk about technology topics and kind of hit an education loop to bring some folks, especially you youngsters out there who are real curious about how all this fits together. We're going to be doing a series of these about technology, mostly internet-based technology, because that's my expertise. That's what I do. I do internet-type technology. And on today's show, we're going to first, in the first segment, the next segment after this, actually, we're going to talk about what is a database. And I'm just kind of going for it. I didn't really take a lot of notes, but I've taught this before at the university level, and I've done it professionally for about 25 years now. So I don't expect I'll have any issues introducing everyone to that topic. And I'll try to keep the language simple. About, you know, how databases work and what the different kinds of databases are. Then we're going to move on and talk about who invented the internet, which is very difficult to answer. Then after that, we'll have another break. We'll actually have breaks here, commercial breaks, just like regular hour-long radio. Then we'll be talking about one of the internet's progenitors. That's Mr. Alan Turing. And he played a very special role in computers in general. And without him, it's arguable we would not have the computers that we have today. He also was involved in the early stages of artificial intelligence. And so he's a very interesting character. And there are lots of books that have been written about Alan Turing, that's A-L-A-N-T-U-R-I-N-G, that I think you should go out and read up on this guy. He's very interesting and eclectic character. And you may be surprised, pleasantly or not so pleasantly, about some of his personal attributes as well. We're only going to be covering some things that regarding Alan Turing today that will be mostly related to his professional life. And then last but not least, we'll be getting into James Gosling. And James Gosling is the inventor of the Java programming language. So stay tuned. We will be back. Let's see, where are we at? We should be hearing some intro music coming in right about now. Or not. This is our first time trying this format, so bear with us, folks, as we try to get this all figured out. Our studio engineers, we pay them less than we should. So, let's go ahead and roll that intro music. Now, I'm showing 5 after, right? So at 5 minutes after, we're going to have the break. So it's not quite 5. I'm seeing 4 after. Is that what you got, too? Oh, your angle is wrong. Okay, that's all right. We're all going off of this Skyscan clock that gets its time. So we actually have another 30 seconds. So okay, get ready. We're going to have some intro music coming in right about in about 15 seconds. And then after that, we'll get into our primary content, what is a database. But we'll also, in just a moment, we're going to have a short commercial break, a minute break, and we'll be back right after that. Growing Business Solutions is an LLC started in Tucson, Arizona in 2004. This is John Dale, everyone. I founded Growing Business Solutions as the master's thesis for the McGuire Center for Entrepreneurship, Concentration in Entrepreneurship. Since then, I've worked professionally in enterprise software, delivering solutions to healthcare. I've delivered encryption software for the largest credit union in Canada. I put together a 52-gun raffle for law enforcement, a law enforcement association. I've delivered for higher ed, K-12, and other firms. I can design and build these applications from the ground up. They're scalable, fast, secure, privacy certified. I can also conduct audits and I can perform consulting of many different technological varieties. Again, that's growingbusinesssolutions.com. Thank you. Hey, everybody. So we're back. I hope you enjoyed that commercial break. This is just how the format's done. So let's talk a little bit about what is a database. Let's talk high level, conceptual. What is data, first of all? Data are little pieces of information that you might collect. Pieces of data are like your tire pressure in your car. It's like, the color of your car, the size of its engine. Those are each pieces of individual pieces of data. And when we collect that data together, that's basically called a database. When we collect little pieces of data like that together, weather information is data, constellations of the stars, that's data. The colors of anything is data, weight, mass is data. Test scores are data. Data is just everywhere. Your healthcare information is data. Your banking information is data. Every time there's a transaction, it involves several pieces of data, like who it's to, who it's from, the date, and how much. And so each little piece of data, they can be brought together, and they can be, when they're brought together, that's a database. So when you bring in information together, that's basically a database. And of course, it involves computers most of the time, but you can actually have a database that's all paper. They used to have databases in real estate offices of all the different properties and attributes. And bringing all of that data together, whether it's in paper form or whatever, that technically can be considered to be a database. So that's fundamentally what a database is. Now, when databases were first accumulated on the walls of caves, arguably, identifying the types and shapes of animals, we changed the format. That became very inefficient to store information that way. And so then we figured out, stone tablets. And then we figured out maybe paper, animal skins, and then maybe paper, and then pencils. And then fast forward, thousands of years, and what do you have? You have computers that are able to store tremendous amounts of data. And it gets unwieldy very quickly. And they discovered this from the first days of computing, how difficult it can be to store data. And when you start talking about collecting weather data, all the banking data, supply chain data for getting a product from the manufacturer to the wholesaler, and then eventually to the retailer, eventually to the customer, all of that is just generating tons of data. So computers became tuned, and we started making our computers to be able to deal with all of that data and make sense of it and put it together. So you could do things like add up the total transactions, or you could say, what is the total cost of our supply chain, which is a very valuable conglomeration of data. And it quickly became apparent that we needed some real smart people to figure out how we could use our computers to make sense of that. So the database evolved into something closer to what we might see today. Now, flat files is a type of database where you just have a text file that contains that data. Then we got spreadsheets, which could add things up and tabulate data and make things look kind of like they're in a ledger. And eventually we got what's called the relational database. And a relational database allows you to create silos or types of repositories that hold on to different types of data. So you could actually say, here's the automobile data, here's the automobile parts data, here is the reordering data, other supply chain management type data. There's just so much data out there. Here is the messaging data. Data that's a message from one person to another. here. And so it's just tremendous. And once we started collecting data as a computer industry, we just kind of went hog wild, you know. We started collecting so much data. And it's tough to argue that we have not collected too much data, but that's actually beyond the scope of this conversation. Maybe we'll have that conversation someday. But we have collected a lot of this data. But what becomes very interesting is that that data can be related. And so we have this thing called an RDBMS. That's a relational database management system. And that's a special piece of software that allows us to very quickly associate different types of data. So you might say, John Dale's banking data. So now we have me, John Dale, which is a people type of data, and we can associate that to John Dale's bank account, which has, I think, about $8 in it right now. So we associate those two pieces of data with each other, and then we relate them, and that helps us to make sense of things. You might want to know, as a bank corporate type manager, what is the total amount of money that our bank has? In which case you'd add it up all, and then maybe even display it by bank with a total at the bottom. It's the relational database management system that does that work. And the format, the structure of the data on the file system has gotten very complex. And that's why we have these very big, really, in terms of the footprint of it. The RDBMS has gotten pretty big, but it's also super fast. It understands the math of how computers store things, and it makes it really fast to add up and associate pieces of disparate information. And that's what we know now today as the modern day RDBMS, a relational database management system. And some examples of these are MySQL, TopLink is a tool for databases, Oracle, SQL Server. There's another big one. DB2 is IBM's. SQL Server is Microsoft's database, and Oracle is Oracle's database. MySQL is an open source database that people built themselves because they were sick of dealing with big corporations and they wanted assurance that the code was doing what it was supposed to do. And so we ended up getting a lot of different flavors, but there's some standardization, kind of like the sizes of bolts and the stroke length of a piston, the compression ratio. There's different options and stuff that vary from car to car, but generally speaking, if you have a set of tools and you're a good mechanic, you can work on all of them. Databases work a similar way, to where if you know how to use one database and speak its language, then you can generally speak the language of all of the different databases. And so that's pretty useful, because once you can start to have a language you can with the database, you can start making conversations with the database and performing logic over the database. Some examples that come to mind immediately are, you know, were there any issues with this election? Election information is stored in a database. And that's a very important function of databases. And being able to ask those questions of a database from a totally remote location has certain ramifications, doesn't it? The language that is used to speak to databases is called SQL. That's SQL. SQL. We call it SQL. Like the sequel to a movie. But instead of SEQUEL, it's SQL. And that stands for Structured Query Language. That's SQL. And that's the language of the relational database management system. So that's basically what a database is conceptually. And an overview in just a few minutes of how the database has evolved over time. And then why it morphed into what we now know as the modern relational database management system. So thank you so much for joining me on this particular segment. We'll be back in just a few short minutes. Check out these ads, please, and do support our sponsors. And we'll be back in just a few minutes to talk about the internet and who invented the internet. If there even is one single person that you can point to that invented the internet, I don't think there is. But we'll get into that discussion in just a little bit. Thank you so much. We'll be right back. This is John Dale. I want to share something with you that is near and dear to my heart, and that is my computer monitor. I'm a computer professional. I sit in front of this thing for my job every day, sometimes as much as 18 hours at a time. Over the years, I've been doing this for decades. I've developed something called computer vision syndrome. I have light sensitivity issues when I look away from the monitor. Now, if I step away from the computer for a while, it feels better. I have to work. I have to get my job done. And that's why I prefer digital ink monitors by DB to Dom. These things use that digital ink like an e-reader, so you don't have this light blasting into your face. They're awesome. Check it out. Go to dbtodom.com today. The Light Phone 2 is a premium, minimal phone. It will never have any social media, clickbait news, email, an internal browser, or any other anxiety-inducing infinite feeds. It's an experience we call going light. It's a phone, it calls, it texts. There's a customizable menu of simple tools and a dashboard website to manage everything. There's a headphone jack, Bluetooth, and it can be used as a personal hotspot. The phone uses unique electric paper screen technology, also found in popular e-readers. This does not emit any blue light like a traditional backlit screen. It's visible in direct sunlight and limited to black and white, intentionally. So if you're interested in the Light Phone, go to thelightphone.com and tell him John Dale sent you. When the internet first came out, it promised to connect the world, and it did. Unfortunately, baked into the internet is the ability to get information about other people, like lots of information of every imaginable type. We believe over time that by respecting your right to privacy, our communities become stronger and more trustworthy. At dbtodom.com, we believe that is a good thing to work for. Thank you. Hello, everyone. This is John Dale of Pretty Little Ditties. I play original music, and I do a lot of improv with my presentation. Every performance is different. I also love to teach and interact with people who appreciate and enjoy live music from a real person. I have deep knowledge and experience in music, and it comes through in the playing that I work hard to be able to bring to your event. If you'd like to have me out, please don't hesitate to drop me a note at info@plainstribune.com. Again, that's Pretty Little Ditties. That's what I'm calling my little music venture. So I'd love to hear from you. Thank you. Perfect. Back. Thanks so much for remaining with us. I hope you enjoyed that break. Please do check out our sponsors. Very important stuff. In this segment, we're going to tackle a very interesting topic. I hope to intrigue you, and I hope you come away with some knowledge that you did not have before. Let's talk briefly about, first of all, what is the internet? So the internet is a connection of tubes. Not really. It's a reduction of numbers and letters to other forms of numbers and letters. I'm going to say that again. The internet is a reduction of numbers and letters to base 2. So what that means is I can represent the letter A, for instance, as the number 1. Let's just keep it really simple. The letter A is encoded as the number 1. Now, in base 10, the number 1 is 1. In binary, the number 1 is 01. In binary, the number 2 is 10, because it rolls over quicker. In base 10, we roll over at 9. Every time we get to 9, we roll over to the next 10. But in binary, base 2, we roll over at 2, basically. So 0 is the first one and 1 is the second number, and then we go back to 0 again. So in terms of the number places, we have, you know, tens, 100s, 1,000s, 1,000s place, and so on. In base 10, it's a little different in binary, and the number of digits to represent the same number is actually larger. But when we do it this way, when I say 2 is B, and 2 in binary is 10, that's the important insight. So just think about that. B is 10. A is 01. Now imagine you have a wire and there's a current going over the wire. And let's say that you can reduce that current or increase that current, and that can be detected on the other side of the wire. So now I can decrease the current and send the number 0. I can increase the current and send the number 1. That's fundamentally how the internet works. Morse code is similar, with the exception that it is dashes and dots instead of zeros and ones. But it's a very similar concept, and it was a very quite powerful way of communicating back in the day before we were able to even send our vocals, our voices, over the telephone wire. Morse code is a predecessor to what we now know as the modern-day internet. Now imagine modulating that signal millions of times per second. And I think China just came out with something that can send like terabits per second. So the game in the internet world is to be able to modulate that signal faster, because then you can send data faster. You can send A, B, C, D, 0, 1, 2, 3, and so on. You can send those much faster. And that's basically how the internet works. So when you start to talk about, you know, who invented the internet, it becomes a very difficult question, because one of the first modes of communication that used a similar technology was actually in Africa. Tribes of that region, from across the river and down the river, used to play drums to one another to send wireless messages to one another. So did they invent the internet? And before they were using drums to do it, perhaps there were other means of sending that kind of remote, codified message, an encoded message that's been transferred into a different format and then transferred back into a format that our brains understand. So who invented the internet? That's a really good and difficult question. Some people say, well, the modern day internet was invented by DARPA. DARPA, let's see, that's the Defense Advanced Research, D-A-R, Defense Advanced Research Program. What's the A in DARPA? You want to go look? Could you go look up the A in DARPA? We'll bring that one back. So some people say that they did it with this program called AlohaNet. And AlohaNet was able to send a message via a kind of like Morse code, but really a binary message to Hawaii. That's why they call it AlohaNet. You can do some further reading on that if you like. I recommend it. So was that the invention of the internet? How about the dude who invented Ethernet? What's the A stand for? Agency. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. That's DARPA. So did DARPA invent the internet? Well, I don't know. Did Alan Turing invent the internet? There are a lot of philosophers who worked in the philosophy of the mind and in the computing, early computing industry. Who did they invent the internet? There were a lot of people, as with anything that's really good in our society, right? When humanity comes up with something real good, it's always a result of work that people before that individual did. I mean, everything, every bit of food that fueled the ancestors of that person, every little discovery that was chained together that led to that invention. I mean, this type of question is just very difficult. Bernards Lee, I think, is the inventor of Ethernet. Then there's the TCP, Transmission Control Protocol, which managed the chunks of information that was sent over that physical link. And they just kept putting layers on it until eventually we had this thing called HTTP. And this is thought of as the capstone of the internet. When we were able to send HTTP, Hypertext Transfer Protocol, HTTP data over Ethernet, over TCP, which was on top of Ethernet. They call it the Internet Stack. When we were able to do that, that seems like a good moment to say, yeah, that's kind of when the internet, as we know, the modern day internet was invented. That application stack is, let me just review that. And you can read up on this stuff individually. Wikipedia is a good resource for this kind of stuff. You can read up on this individually. But basically, you have the physical link, which is the actual copper or fiber optic wire. And then within that, there's a signal that gets modulated one way or another. It gets modulated so that you can send zeros and ones, which then can be used to encode letters and numbers, which are the building blocks for all that data. And then TCP, Transmission Control Protocol, over Internet Addressing, TCP/IP, was what allowed us to give computers addresses and call up to them and send and receive information to them over the physical link using TCP. And then HTTP was the ability to structure information that was formatted and beautified and organized. So that's kind of when the internet was invented, but it's almost impossible to say who actually invented the internet. So there you go. That's my answer. We'll be back in just a little bit here. Take another quick break, and then we'll be back to talk about a gentleman named Alan Turing, who invented the Turing test.
Howdy! If you're like me, you really enjoy the satisfaction that comes from harvesting your own vegetables from your very own garden using this incredible soil we have here in Spearfish. But I wanted to remind you, now is really the beginning of next season. Start thinking about your garden now. We have two farmers markets in town, and the people go there looking for produce. So we need more people to be putting stuff in the ground now. I know there's a Black Hills Master Gardeners Club organization that you could reach out to for help. Also, there, just look it up, the farmers markets. You can touch base with them probably on Facebook and other means. Go find them online and reach out to them for advice, tips, and pointers. And go ahead and put some seeds down. Thanks, everybody. This is John, by the way, John Dale. Have a great day. We love our dogs. We love our pets. But sometimes we just can't afford to take them to the vet, and we have to do something unmentionable. If you or your family or friends find themselves in this circumstances, there's something that you can do. Call Hobo's Healing Heart or look them up on Facebook. I'm not a representative of them, but I would like to wholeheartedly recommend them to you before you consider doing the unthinkable to one of your most loyal, lifelong companions. Howdy, folks. Hey, are you struggling to find a way to stay fit in the wintertime? It's just so easy to kick your feet up and have that fourth cup of hot chocolate with marshmallows, isn't it? Well, I solved this problem for myself about 3 years ago when I started cross-country skiing. We found our way up to the Big Hill facility here near Spearfish. You just hop on Tinton Road, you head up there on Big Hill. That's maintained by Nordic Ski Group. I can't think of the, the Black Hills Nordic Ski Club or something like that. They're on Facebook. If you look up Black Hills Nordic Skiing and cross-country skiing, you'll definitely be able to find them. It's changed my life. It gives me that edge in winter. I don't put on that extra 5 or 10 pounds that then I'm looking at every spring. And it feels great for those of you who are active. I can wholeheartedly recommend that you head up to Big Hill and check out those trails. Also look them up on Facebook and get some pointers and tips for your skis and how to wax them and how you can help to be a good citizen up there. So anyway, I'd like to personally thank Nordic Ski Club folks up there for the work they do maintaining that trail. It's a life changer and it's awesome. It's something that I think I would like to see become more popular in the area. Thanks, everybody. Oh, this is John Dale, by the way. Have a great day. Welcome back. My name is John Dale, by the way, broadcasting from Spearfish, South Dakota. In this segment, we're going to talk about a gentleman who's no longer with us named Alan Turing. He was a fairly controversial figure, but we're not going to talk about that aspect of the man. We're going to talk about his contributions to mathematics and computer science. He was a philosopher, a theoretical biologist. He was born 1912, and he died 1954, so he was not that old when he passed away, but an absolute genius. He was a cryptanalyst, a logician. He was critical in creating and cracking codes in World War II for the United States, a computer scientist, an English mathematician, so for the Allied forces, I should say. His name, Alan Matheson Turing. Turing was highly influential in the development of theoretical computer science, providing a formalization of the concepts of algorithm. He created a conceptual device that was able to save its current state, and it was able to modify its state, and it was able to address pieces of information or data in the process of executing what we would call now a program. He's widely considered to be the father of theoretical computer science and artificial intelligence, and that is Alan Turing. What Alan Turing is most widely known for is his contribution of a test in the field of artificial intelligence. Now, in order to understand artificial intelligence, you do need to understand a little bit about the human brain and how it works. It's an incredible computing device. The human brain is very sophisticated. It's a parallel processing device. It's like if you can have one rig make 100 trips, or you can have 100 rigs make one trip. The human brain is the latter. LATTER. The human brain is a massively parallel system. I mean, it is fast, dude. Super, super fast. And the way it works is it has neurons, and these neurons have incoming connections to them,
and they have outgoing connections. And basically, the way it works, if you can believe this, is that a neuron will only fire, meaning only activate its outgoing connections with a little bit of electricity, if its input is correct. So sometimes that neuron needs a certain level of input in order to propagate that energy through it to other neurons. And we're talking trillions of these things, trillions of operations, just incredible massive parallel processing. But at that fundamental level, that's what's going on. That's what's happening is it's called the interactive activation and competition model. And what that means is it works because these neurons are connected together and they'll propagate information through them and let information flow through them, and then they can, it's almost like magic, but it's not. And we've been studying this, we humanity, for a very long time. And once they would look at people who died on the battlefield, and then doctors would go and dissect them and look at stuff under the microscope. And then animals were used. They'd cut open animals and look inside animals to look at their brains and see how those were kind of put together. And they noticed these special cells, by the way, that don't really replicate like other cells in your body. They noticed that these cells were all hooked together. And then eventually we developed really sophisticated scanning equipment, and we could watch the flow of electricity in the brains of different critters in real time, until eventually we just concluded, you know, there must be some power in the way that this is all organized. So what do we think it is? So some of our real smart people like Alan Turing and others got together and they started really thinking hard about how does this actually work? And where is consciousness? Where is me? Where is my soul located? All of these issues were intimately intertwined in the study of the human brain. And so once they figured it out, they started to, once computers came online, they were able to use computers to simulate neurons and the connections between them. And eventually they were able to do some very rudimentary simulations, okay? We do not have computers that are anywhere close to the human brain. We don't even know. I still leave room for the possibility that the human brain is connected to God in some way. And these silicone things are not. And that's, I'll let you fill in the blanks on that and what that means to you. But there's something extremely special about human beings. I think that they're just the most incredible critters. And once we learned how the brain basically functions, we were able to simulate some of that. And so the brain can recognize shapes and it can navigate terrain. Now we have neural networks. That's why they call them that, neural networks, in software that simulate how the brain works. And sure as heck, it wasn't a matter of time, and they actually were able to get some successful tests and figure out that this actually works to do computing. This actually works. And so they validated their assumptions about how the brain works. But then, as scientists are apt to do, they start arguing with each other. They start getting into it in their papers and in their journals, in phone calls, at conferences, over drinks. I bet there were even bar fights over this issue. And that is, when have you developed a neural network that is functionally equivalent to a human being, right? And I've even alluded to this in my comment about connection to God. When is the thing going to be human? And Alan Turing just to try to put an end to these bar fights, I imagine, these computer science bar fights, these nerds getting down and dirty, breaking bottles, pulling knives on each other in the bar. I mean, it must have been ruthless. It must have been absolutely ruthless. Alan Turing finally said, enough, enough. And he had enough street cred in neuroscience and mathematics and computer science to say, well, listen, I've devised a test. I, Alan Turing, have devised a test. A computer is human if you put it in another room and it can only interact with another human being via text messages. Via text messages. So a person types in something into the computer and it goes in to the other little AI, right? An artificial non-human intelligence in the other room, which then types back and it reads it out. And if you can't tell that you're talking with a computer, if you don't know, then that passes what's known as the Turing test. That's the Turing test. And that's what he devised just to stop these guys slashing each other in the alley out behind False Bottom, you know. That's what they did. I'm pretty sure that that's the reason. But if you got other info on that, you please do let me know. And that's Alan Turing. And that's his major contribution, was stopping all of these horrendously bloody and violent bar fights between nerds of the day. At least that's what's bouncing around in my melon. That's what I probably think happened. And that's the Turing test. That's known as the Turing test. Alan Turing, English mathematician, computer scientist, logician, cryptanalyst, philosopher, and theoretical biologist. Turing was highly influential in the development of theoretical computer science, providing a formalization of the concepts of algorithm and computation with the Turing machine, which was a conceptual machine that he was able to describe on paper in a couple pieces of notebook paper, which can be considered a model of a general-purpose computer. And sure enough, what we see today in these extremely high-powered computers all over the world is basically Alan Turing's initial generalized computer. And that's how it worked. And that's Mr. Alan Turing. You've been listening to our Computer Day, our Nerd Day here at Plains Tribune on the Friday Mashup. I hope you enjoyed the content so far. We'll be back to talk about another character within computing named James Gosling. He's known widely as the inventor of the Java programming language. We'll be right back after this. Over the years, I've been doing this for decades. I've developed something called computer vision syndrome. I have light sensitivity issues when I look away from the monitor. Now, if I step away from the computer for a while, it feels better. But I have to work. I have to get my job done. And that's why I prefer digital ink monitors by DB Tadom. These things use that digital ink like an e-reader, so you don't have this light blasting into your face. They're awesome. Check it out. Go to dbtadom.com today. The Lite Phone 2 is a premium, minimal phone. It will never have any social media, clickbait news, email, an internal browser, or any other anxiety-inducing infinite feeds. It's an experience we call going light. It's a phone, it calls, it texts. There's a customizable menu of simple tools and a dashboard website to manage everything. There's a headphone jack, Bluetooth, and it can be used as a personal hotspot. The phone uses unique electric paper screen technology, also found in popular e-readers. This does not emit any blue light like a traditional backlit screen. It's visible in direct sunlight and limited to black and white, intentionally. So if you're interested in the Lite Phone, go to thelitephone.com and tell them John Dale sent you. When the internet first came out, it promised to connect the world, and it did. Unfortunately, baked into the internet is the ability to get information about other people. Like lots of information. Of every imaginable type. We believe over time that by respecting your right to privacy, our communities become stronger and more trustworthy. At dbtodom.com, we believe that is a good thing to work for. Thank you. Welcome back. We've been talking today about the internet and technology and databases and who invented the whole thing. But it's come to my attention, my producers here have mentioned that I may have had a piece of factually incorrect information during the Alan Turing segment. It may not have been the case that there were bar fights as incentive that Alan Turing wanted to stop in order to create his Turing test. You'll have to go read up on that yourself. If you didn't detect the sarcasm and need to be convinced that that was not actually the impetus, but I bet you there was at least one. I bet there was at least one bar fight. That's all I'm saying. So on today's program, we've discussed what is a database. That was a huge part of computing in general, is the database. And it has enabled so much in our society, and but also it has enabled a lot of nefarious things too. We're not going to get into the morality of computing on this particular show, but that's definitely an issue that we think about a lot. Then we talked about who might have invented the internet. Almost impossible to pinpoint it exactly. Even in France, they used to use windmills with special blades on them that they could change the shape to send information wirelessly. So it's tough to know where to give credit on that. Then we talked about Alan Turing, and how he was the progenitor of the Turing test and saved the day, probably saved a lot of lives. But now we're going to get into one of my favorite topics, and that is the programming language of Java. The gentleman who invented it, his name is James Gosling. He's a physicist. And he was born in 1955, a Canadian computer scientist, best known as the founder and lead designer behind the Java programming language. By the way, I'm getting this information about Alan Turing and James Gosling from Wikipedia. You can follow up there. I think there are books that have been written about both of these guys, most certainly Turing. Gosling was elected a member of the National Academy of Engineering in 2004 for the conception and development of the architecture. For the Java programming language, and for contributions to Windows systems. That's not Windows systems, but he helped to figure out how to do Windows systems that would keep a context of what you were doing in a certain program, and then you could switch back and forth, and it made people more productive. But let's talk a little bit about what is a programming language. If you can imagine, the original computer operators were like the Morse code guys sitting in that telegraph office in the old western town before people would come riding into town, firing their guns in the air, and so on. And when you needed to send a telegraph, there was a dude in there who had that hat on and the special uniform. By the way, that was not actual Morse code. If you tried to decode that, it could be a swear word. Be careful. anyway, that was like the original sort of operating system of the original computational model of the internet. So, but that's really inefficient because not everybody understands that. Not everybody knew what Morse code was or how to do it, you know? So as the computer was developed and as the internet was developed, what you see is like kind of like on a car. When you want to push in the clutch, you don't have to reach down to the transmission and push a lever. You got it right there at your feet. When you want to press the gas, you don't have to reach up or have a wire around your finger pulling the butterfly valve on your carburetor. And so on with the brakes and shifting gears. There's like a layer. There's several layers over the core functions of that vehicle that give you a dashboard to operate it. And so we have the same phenomenon in computers. You have lots of layers that are added to the computer to make it more useful so you don't have to have your finger on a little telegraph doodad. I don't even know what that's called. What's that telegraph doodad called? Could you go look that up? What is that called, that piece at the end? I'm sure probably most of you actually know that out there. So there's lots of layers added over it. And one of those layers is Ethernet. Another layer is TCP, Transmission Control Protocol. Another layer is HTTP, Hypertext Transfer Protocol. And within that, there are stacks of programming languages. And the general trend is that it right down at the bottom of that stack is the most raw. Like if you're looking at actual compression and explosions happening in the cylinders of, it's like you're right there, you're seeing it. But it's very difficult to envision how you would even operate that vehicle if you're looking at the motor. You need to be looking elsewhere. So those layers are added over there to give more functionality, to make it easier to use. And as we see the development of these layers, each layer that gets added on gets closer to the English language. And even now you can see, if you're in touch with technology, you can see things like ChatGPT that is like you can use English to generate and create working functional computer code. And that ChatGPT is actually going to use what we use now, computer programmers use now. I don't actually approve. I think that we have what we need. We have enough layers, and it's close enough to the human language. It's like taking the steering wheel off of a car. I don't approve. I think that's going too far. ChatGPT applied to programming for me is the similar way. That's just a value statement, if you'll give me that latitude. So what we see is as those layers are added, it gets closer to the English language. Now, some of those languages, I'm just going to kind of name them very quickly. You have assembler and machine code, which is the most difficult. That's like being inside the engine. And then we have the C programming language, which is like if you're pulling the butterfly valve on the carb manually. Then we got C++, which is kind of like, that was pretty good. That's like a 1970 Barracuda that you've just absolutely roasted out. I mean, it's just real bare bones, like a stock car that you might race on a dirt track. That's kind of the equivalent of C++. It's pretty awesome, but it's not quite as functional as a finished sort of product, like maybe a 1989 Mitsubishi 4-banger 5-speed pickup, right? That's what I would call Java. Extremely useful. And the Java programming language takes care of some stuff. Whenever you create a program, you're using resources. It's called allocation. And you end up using resources within that computer to do your program. It makes sense, right? You're using resources in that computer to do your program. And when you're done with your program, then all those resources need to get cleaned up. And sometimes during the operation of your program, you need to clean those resources up, because when you're in, say, an RDBMS, you want to be able to go and look at a huge trove of data. You can't bring a 90 terabyte database into your working space of your computer, so you have to work on little bits of it. And as you go through and work on those little bits of it, you've got to deallocate the resources as you go. And what Java did was, it was a huge revolution, a huge improvement over C++ for the average programmer, because we were able to not have to worry as much about that. Because Java, and James Gosling, to his credit, brought in what's called the garbage collector. The garbage collector allows you to simply toss away a resource in your program and not have to worry about specifically deallocating it. And that was huge. In addition, the way that Java is structured, it just cleaned up some of the messiness, trimmed out a lot of the messiness of C++, so that as you're going through and reading and modifying and improving your software code, then you're able to get a good flow of understanding, because things were just cleaner. It stayed out of your way. And it was awesome. I've been using Java now for 20 some odd years. It has been incredible improvement over C++ that I started with. And so I'm very happy with James Gosling's work. And since then, Java has this huge community of people who have rallied around it as a clear winner in developing some of the world's most mission-critical systems, including things like the optics processing on the Mars rover, banking systems use it, military supply chain uses Java. And the reason is because we were able to dedicate more of ourselves to getting the program right and less of ourselves to cleaning up after it. Well, folks, that's all I have for now. Thank you for joining me. It's been a pleasure. We'll see you next time. Have a great day, everybody. Hey, just for you folks who stuck around, it's the Telegraph Key. The Telegraph Key. I'm fully booked, I just got the time of day. And all my friends are busy bees. They got
their queens and ducks all in a row. Well, hold up, Wayne, can we listen to the guitar? Cause all my friends are heading out, 'cause all my friends, I think I'll stick around. Let's have another round.